Anyways, we are talking about the prodigal son. Luke chapter 15 is where we're going to be. And it's a story where Jesus is telling a story about lost things. And he's talking to two groups of people. It couldn't be more diverse. We talked about this past week. One group of people are the worst of the worst, the sinners and the tax collectors, people that everybody in society pretty much looked upon and said, those are the worst of the worst people. And there's also another group of people that were standing there listening to Jesus, and those were people who considered themselves to be better than everybody else, to be the best of the best. And so those are the two groups of people that Jesus is talking to, and he uses this opportunity to tell some stories about being lost. He tells a story about lost coins, he tells a story about lost sheep, tells a story about a lost son, and we're really just focusing in on the story about the lost son. And I think it'd be dumb to ask the question, anybody ever been lost? Probably maybe you should ask, anybody got lost this week? Maybe probably be more appropriate. I mean, we always get lost. We have a tendency to get lost. And there's a couple principles that are true about getting lost. It doesn't matter. There's some principles that are just so true. It doesn't matter if you love God, hate God, love Jesus, don't love Jesus, go to church, don't go to church. These are principles that are true no matter what. And there's some principles about being lost that are just true. Number one is nobody ever wants to get lost. Now, maybe some of you have tried to get lost or want to get lost, but let's face it, 9 out of 10 times, you don't want to get lost. The last thing you want when you're trying to get somewhere and you got somewhere you got to be is to get lost on the way. You don't try to get lost. It's just kind of something that happens. And the second thing about lostness is it's hard to tell just when you got lost, but eventually you come to the realization that you are lost. And the part that creates tension in marriages, of course, is that usually women and men have different sensors as to when that point happens, right? You know, like, for whatever, women seem to have this sense that you're almost lost all the time. At least that's the way I see it from my perspective. And when really they're able to figure out, I don't think we're going in the right, there's like this really weird, like, sixth sense that they have. Maybe it's with the power of the extra rib or something. They use that, and they have this, like, sixth sense that just says, I don't think we're going in the right direction. Whereas guys, it takes a little while longer for that to kind of kick in, but I think what that is, I think we just have faith in the road that we're on, right? We have faith in our abilities at some point to turn this thing around and to make a bad road become a good road. And if we just make better time, and when I show you, honey, listen, this may not be the right way to go, but if we get there faster on this road, it'll all work out in the end, right? So we kind of have that thought, but eventually it hits everybody in the car, yes, we're lost, okay? So at some point it's going to hit you that you are on the wrong road. At some point you're going to realize it. And what's really frustrating is sometimes it's hard to figure out when you got lost. You know how that happened? I remember the very first argument that Melissa and I had in Virginia Beach. And by the way, they should not call this place Hampton Roads. They should call this place Jacked Up Roads, because if you've been here any length of time, you should not have to give somebody six directions, like turn left, turn right, turn left, turn left, just to stay on Princess Anne. You shouldn't have to do that, right? And every other road in town's like that. And the very first argument let me back up. Melissa and I never argued. We had intense moments of fellowship where I tried to convince her of my way of thinking. Believe that if you will. So anyways, we're trying to get to this restaurant off Baxter. And it was intersection of Princess Anne and Baxter. And we're coming up Princess Anne, and she goes, she has a sense, she goes, I don't think we're going the right way. I'm like, trust me, we're fine. This is before the days of GPS, all right? So I don't have the iPhone to bail me out. We had a paper map, okay? That's how old school this was back. And it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have this stuff, but it was paper map. Why get that out? It's just, you know, it thinks it takes up the whole front of the car. We're good, we're fine. And she has the audacity to say to me, you made a wrong turn. I said, honey, I haven't turned. She says, well, you made a wrong turn somewhere because we're on Indian River, not Princess Anne. And I said, I'll tell you, woman, we have not made a turn. Right? I know, I'm driving. I didn't make any wrong turns. I hadn't even turned. And she looks at me, she says, well, I don't know what you think you've been doing driving. Because you know how you talk and you just kind of lose track. And she goes, I don't know what you think. You can tell me all you want you haven't made a wrong turn. But what I know is we were on Princess Anne, and now we're on Indian River. And I said, well, I have not made any turns. We didn't know the roads. So we did the thing that every guy hates doing, and that is you got to turn the car around. It's just like the U-turn of shame, isn't it? It's like you feel like everybody in town's like laughing, hey, you make a U-turn after you messed up. And that girl's smiling, you know, and the guy's like, you know. So I make the U-turn, we head back, and I'm like, we're on Indian River. We got to go back and find the intersection of Indian River, Princess Anne. And we're driving. I'm looking for the cross streets of Princess Anne. We get all the way back to the courthouse. And Melissa goes, "You moron, we're on Princess Anne." It's like, no, there's no way we could be. She goes, "Well, look right there." I'm like, "I haven't made any turns." So we get back. We do that stretch like 3 times. No lie, all right? Right? I mean, and she's like, "You're on Farrell Parkway now." I'm like, "I didn't turn." You got to take the little side street if you're new to town. And that night just went from bad to worse. So you know, you have those moments where you just don't want to be in the car anymore with that person. We're both at that point. So we're there, and it's one of those nights we're going out to dinner with somebody from the church, and it's always one of those nights. You have those moments of pastors like, "Honey, just come out to dinner with me. Somebody from the church want to meet." And, you know, she's like at the end of the long day, doesn't want to go anywhere. She's great with child. This is back when we were pregnant with Jackson. It's like, "I don't want to go anywhere." Like, "You know, honey, I committed us, so let's go." And we get there, and it's this like Asian restaurant, and we walk in, and everybody's on the floor. Like, the table's like this high off the ground. And she looks at me, and it was just, she gives me the look. You get lost, and then you didn't even ask questions about where we're going, and you think my pregnant body's going to kneel on the floor to eat? You're out of your mind. Fortunately, it was like an optical illusion. They were actually sitting, like the seats are down low. I don't know what the restaurant is. It's over off back, so you actually sit down on the ground. So actually, it looks like for everybody who's standing up that you're kneeling, but really you're actually sitting on a bench. It'd be kind of like going like this at the table. So it looks like as if I'm like kneeling if you're up here, but really I'm not. Anyways, all that to say, it was a bad night. So back to point number 3 is if you're on the wrong road, this is really profound. If you're on the wrong road, you're never going to get the right destination. So everybody gets lost. You don't always know you're lost until you're lost. And then lastly, if you're on the wrong road, you're never going to get to the right destination. I mean, if you head west looking for the beach, you're not going to find it, right? Every guy in the room just said eventually. Every one of you. Every one of you just said, "You know, honey, don't tell me where we're going. This road will lead to a beach. Trust me, there's one on each coast, and eventually we'll get there." Right? Might be 2 months later, but we'll get there. You know, it worked the first service, too. Every guy in the room says eventually, and the girls are like, "That's just how it is, right, guys? Trust me, it's a principle. If you're going the wrong direction on the wrong road, it ain't going to get you to the right place. It doesn't matter how good a time you're making, it's going to go to the wrong place." So that's what kind of you need to know going into this, because Jesus tells stories about lost things, and those are some principles we just need to like kind of remind ourselves. If we're going to be looking at lost things, got to have those principles about lostness in the back of our mind so we can understand where Jesus is going and why he's telling us about lost things. You don't want to be lost. You don't always realize you're lost until you're lost, and if you're on the wrong road, you're going to stay lost until you get back on the right road. So with that, we read about this guy who gets lost. And just side note, it's really easy to tell when you're lost in a car eventually, but it's really difficult for men and women to realize when we're lost financially, spiritually, relationally, morally, and everything else outside of that which happens in a car. It is really hard to tell we're lost, but the same principles still apply. You don't want to get lost. You don't always realize you're lost until you're really lost. And if you keep going on the same road that you're on, you're going to stay lost. All those principles apply to lostness, whether you're in a car or whether you're talking about your life and any area of your life. And so with that, we look at a guy who gets lost. And so Jesus tells this story in Luke 15, verse 11. It says, Jesus continues. So he's just been telling stories about lost stuff, a lost sheep, a lost coin. Now he's going to tell a story about a lost son. And he says, there was a man who had 2 sons. And the younger one said to the father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." And so the father divided his property between them. And not long after that, the younger son took all that he had, and he went and he spent it out into a distant country, and he squandered his wealth on wild living. And when he had spent everything, there was a famine in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him out into the field to feed pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the stuff that the pigs were eating. And no one came to help him or give him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, "You know, how many of my father's servants have food enough to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and I will go back to my father and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So make me one of your hired servants.' And so he got up and he went to the father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, was filled with compassion for him, and he ran to his sons, and he threw his arms around him and kissed him. And the son said, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against earth, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So, and the father just interrupts him, and he says, no, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Kill the fattened calf, and let's have a feast. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost, but now is found. And so they began to celebrate. So you think about, like, the question, how does this happen? Like, how does he get lost? Because you think about it, he's got everything anybody could ask for. When you just kind of take a step back and you look about how he's got it pretty good. He's got a loving father, which is something that many of us in this room can't say. And we long to have a loving father. But he grew up in a loving home with a loving father who pretty much gave him whatever he wanted, it looks like. He had a good job. If you were the son of a wealthy landowner, you had a pretty good gig. You didn't work the fields, you just supervised people working the fields. You didn't cook meals, you just supervised people cooking the meals. And you were basically being brought up to be groomed how to manage an estate, how to manage wealth. And that's really what you were brought up to do. It was a pretty good living. And so he has a good family. He's got a good job. He's got a good future. We already know that the father's got a lot of money. And all he has to do is just wait around to receive it. I mean, it's already in the bank for him. He just has to hang out, keep working the system, and he's got a great future already in store for him. And you can see it. You can look all around it and see it. So much so, he decides he wants it now. And really in this question, if we're going to figure out how is it we get lost, you got to ask this question, is why did the son leave when he had everything that every one of us longed for? You know, why do you leave when you have everything that everybody else longs for? Why is it? Well, he starts off and he says to his dad, give me my share. And you kind of got to think about that for a minute. To understand that request, you kind of have to get out of the American mindset and get into a Middle Eastern mindset. And that's really hard for us to do because we don't have really a culture of respect for adults or respect for parents cultivated in America. I mean, it's a joke, really. I mean, you watch movies, and it's kind of the storyline of a lot of movies. It's even funny the way that the kids sass the parents. You watch, man, I'm like, my kids are just moving out of the cartoon stage, and Jackson is like experimenting with those, you know, those Disney afternoon TV shows. I don't know, Good Luck Charlie, That's So Raven. I don't even know. I mean, I just know the names. I couldn't tell any of them apart. They all look the same to me. They all look like the same storyline, the same characters. They just change their names for each show. But I remember Melissa was babysitting some kids years ago, and they love watching those shows. And I got just peed. I said, we are not. No. Those kids sass their parents every time they turn around. Ugh, ugh, ugh. I mean, every time the dad tells them, the dad's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. On and on, because the kids, they know everything. And that's American culture. Middle Eastern culture, not so much. In American culture, you can have a kid say, Dad, give me what's mine. And be like, I don't think so. And we laugh about it. You hear my kids say, ugh. Now, in their culture, you go and you ask your dad that. Here's what you should expect if you ask that. A smack across the face with the backhand. And then, in that culture, to be driven out of the house with words and blows until you're driven far from the home. And if the father was too old to do it, the servants and the other siblings would join in to do it for him. That's what was to be expected in that culture when that happened. You did not talk to your mom or your dad this way. Period. It just wasn't. And so you got to think, this is a bold statement. This isn't just, hey, Dad, I was just thinking the other day. No, this is something that takes a lot of courage, a lot of moxie to walk in, a lot of audacity, a lot of disrespect to walk in and say, Dad, give me what's mine. I've been thinking about it. I got a lot coming to me when you die. And as far as I'm concerned, you're dead to me. So just give it to me now. Let's just speed up the process. How do you get to the point where you're willing to take that kind of bold step? Well, everything begins with a thought. Every dumb decision we've ever made always begins with a thought. Long before you ever saw the action, there was a thought that went unchecked. It just kind of festered inside. And here's the scary part. It's easy to tell on the back end when an action was a bad action, right? I mean, you can tell eventually, I made a bad decision. The problem is that when you're thinking thoughts, you rarely have if you're going to let a thought fester and grow inside your mind, rarely do people think their thoughts are evil or bad or not good. Or if you do think it's a bad thought, eventually you'll rationalize it to the point where you're like, well, you know, this may not seem right, but if you knew my situation, you and I had to put up with, you know what I'm dealing with, you'd understand this is actually a good thing. Or we convince ourselves, say, well, I know to do it would be bad, but there's nothing wrong with thinking it, right? Nothing wrong with just thinking about it, letting my mind wander. We call those fantasies. We call those daydreams. We call those just thoughts that go in and out of our mind. And we allow them to go completely unchecked because we're convinced, you know, it's not bad just to think it. It's only bad to do it. And so the thought's not bad. So we have all these ways of whitewashing our thoughts. And you allow these thoughts to fester and fester and continue to grow deep within inside your heart. And eventually that thought gets to the point where it wants to take action. Eventually gets to the point where it goes out and it makes that bold thing. Hey, will you just give me what's mine? And to kind of think about what happens in this process of the thoughts that lead to actions is underlining this thought, or underlining the thoughts, the kind of the bedrock of these thoughts that come out, is this idea that what you're doing, or the system that I'm in, or the situation that I'm in, is keeping something really good from me. Like, the son looked at his situation. If you tried to tell him how good he had it in his home, he would have said, yeah, but, you know, dad's holding out on me. There's a whole lot more. How long do you think he was dreaming of that distant country before he packed up his stuff and went there? He knew where he was going. He had it all planned out in his mind. How often do you think he was daydreaming about that distant country? How often do you think he was thinking about, when I get my stuff, here's what I'm going to go to? He was thinking about it. And he was thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And we do the same kind of things. We allow our mind to wander and think to ourselves about what sex would be like with that person instead of my spouse. And we allow our mind to wander and think to ourselves, you know, what if I just made more money? What if I just, you know, had more money at my disposal to go out and spend more? People are often asked, how much money is enough? And almost everybody says, a little more. Most people, when surveyed, say about $10,000 to $20,000, actually, I think it's $20,000 is the number. If I just made $20,000 more a year, it would solve all my problems, and I wouldn't have a care in the world. And you know what's crazy? Is that's for like 90% of, you know, the Americans. When you go into the millionaires, you start to talk to people who are in the millionaire club, they will begin to tell you that if you have a net worth of $5 million, that's when you can really kind of set easy. Isn't it funny? You can talk to somebody who's got $1 million in the bank, and you say, everything's got to be good, right? No. Really, you're not really financially secure until you get $5 million. What? I mean, it's crazy that it's always just a little bit more. And what I have is good, but God's holding out on me. You're holding out on me. That's why Adam and Eve ate the apple. If there was ever a couple that had everything perfect, where did they live? In paradise. They lived in paradise. They were buck naked. And the only thing they had to do was name animals and have sex. That's it. I mean, you just think about that for a minute. How good do you have it when all you got to do is come up with names for animals and have sex? Sign me up, right? That's kind of what all y'all are thinking, all right? And here's the thing, girls. You're the only woman for him. You're the only one he's thinking about. You're the only one around, but you're the only one he's thinking about. I mean, seriously, you are the object of his affection. You are the crowning pinnacle of all of God's creation, and he knows it. How good do you have it? But there was this thought planted there. You know, there's that one tree God says you can't eat. He's holding out on you. You know, what you got is good, but it really could be better if you had that. And there's that thought. And so they eat the apple to see where it goes, to see where it takes them. And you know, it's funny because people look at your marriage, they think, man, she has got it made. And you're thinking, you know, but if I was married to that guy, I'd have it better. People look at the job you have and think, wow, they've got it made. And you ask the guy who's in the job, and he's just thinking, man, if I just had the next rank, if I just had the other job, then it'd be better. And we have this thing that's always out there just saying, what I have is good, but man, it could be so much better if only. And you allow that thought to keep going and going and going and going, and eventually you build up the courage to make a really dumb decision. And you just walk in with the audacity and say, give me. And it says next, I almost missed this one. I got to remind you of a little bit of a redneck wisdom. Everybody loves redneck wisdom, right? I mean, stuff that's so deep, so profound, you're amazing that Jethro said it. I mean, that's redneck wisdom. Redneck wisdom, I've shared this thought before, and that is the grass is always greener on the other side. But that's because it's over a septic tank. Only folks who live out in the country know what I'm talking about right here. If you have city water, you don't know anything about septic tank. But you go out to the country, you go out to Deep South Pungo, you go out there to Pungolians and ask them about septic tanks, and you'll look out there and you'll see brown grass, brown grass, brown grass, especially this time of year because nothing's fertilized. It's been in the winter. They come out there and say, man, how do you get the rest of your grass to grow like that? That's a good place right there. That's where I want to be. And says, I'll tell you why the grass is so green. It's over my septic tank. Septic tank is where all the household waste gets poured out and dispersed over an area in your yard. And that stuff fertilizes the ground really good so the grass grows up really nice. And it looks really nice. And then yourself, that's right there where I would want to be if I was in your yard. And the homeowner says, not the week of Thanksgiving when all my relatives come in town. Because if you know about septic tanks, what happens, you get too many people in the house, you overfill the septic tank, and eventually up from the ground comes a bubbling crude. Smell, that is. It ain't black gold. It's something, but it ain't something good. It is just as nasty as can be. And what looks really good on a nice day, you camp out there, you live there, you set up shop there, eventually you're going to realize you just camped your life out on top of a septic tank. So redneck wisdom, quite profound if you think about it. What you have is good, and you're looking over there thinking that right there is a whole lot better place to be than where I am right now. And somebody's going, yeah, but it's over a septic tank. And you're thinking, but man, the grass is greener. You just wait till Thanksgiving. You just wait till this house gets too many flushes. It's going to... Crude illustration, but it's right. Anyways, moving on. He ends up in a pig slop, all right? So it ain't much different, all right? So then the next thing, he says, so he asked for all his stuff, and then probably the scariest line in this whole story. So the father divided his property between them. You keep going to God and saying, God, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. Here's the scariest part about this. Even though it's not what God wants for you, even though it's not what he has planned for you, even though he knows it's going to hurt you, he'll give it to you. Not because he wants to give it to you, but simply because you want it more than you want him. Eventually says, if that's what you want, you have it. And the crazy thing is we'll actually convince ourselves that because God allowed it to happen, it was God's will, right? I mean, God wouldn't allow me to do anything that wasn't in his will, and so if he gives it to me, I've been asking, he gives it to me, that must obviously mean it's God's will. Well, I remember thinking back on the story of Jonah. Jonah's the story about the guy who gets eaten by a fish, my kind of story. It's got a lot of cool adventure, kind of cool stuff in it. The best thing about it, it's only 4 chapters long, and the chapters are really short. So it's my kind of book. It's like, I can read a whole book in one day if it's the book of Jonah. So you read the story, and Jonah wants to run from God. And so he wants to run from God. God says, basically, go here. He goes down to the dock, and he finds a ship that is just about to leave for here. Coincidence? I think not. Maybe God really doesn't want me here. I mean, if God wanted me here, then why is there a ship that's going here? And I just happen to have enough money to afford it. And so he gets on the boat and he falls fast asleep. He is such at peace with his decision, he falls fast asleep. Yet the text is saying over and over again, this is not where God wants him to be. You go over the book of Deuteronomy, there's a whole several sections in there. This is God's people. They get led out of Egypt, and God leads them by a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. And they have God there leading them every step along the way. And God says, listen, when you get into this new land, I know everybody else has a king. Let me be your king. And the people are like, yeah, after they're there a little while, like, you know, everybody else has a king, we should have a king. And the reason why we have any kind of problems, God, is because we don't have a king. If we had a king, then everything would be great. And God says, you don't want a king. Trust me, you don't want a king. If you get a king, he's going to draft your sons and daughters into war. He's going to take your best daughters for his harem. He's going to take your best land for his own crops. And then on top of that, he's going to charge you high taxes, and he's going to make your life miserable, and you're going to be serving him instead of him serving you. That's how it's going to turn out. So don't go with the king idea. And they say, no, 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 we got to have a king. And what do you find in 1 Samuel? It says God gives them a king. And it was Saul. And he kind of does okay for a little bit, and then he makes a lot of bonehead decisions. Then you got David. He does okay for a little bit, but then he makes a bunch of bonehead decisions. Then you got Solomon. You want to talk about a guy who took some wives for himself? He takes about 700 of them for himself. I mean, just think about it. That's your daughter. And her life now, because the king said so, is just going to be one of his sex slaves that he visits once every 2-3 years. And that's her life, all because you guys had to have a king. And then after Solomon, it goes downhill really, really fast. Why? They wanted a king. And eventually the kings destroy the whole country. God didn't want them to have it, but they asked and they asked and they asked, and eventually he says, okay, have it. You know, I really wish that I could put a shock collar around my kids. Oh, you thought it too. Don't call Child Protective Services. You thought it. Wouldn't it be nice? Your kid's doing something wrong, and from a distance, you could just pull out, there'd be an app for that. You could just go dog collar on child number three. You know, I told you. Because not everything has immediate life consequence. I mean, I remember, you know, Jackson, you know, the kids get the jelly leg syndrome. And I was about sick of that. I took Jackson to the beach one day, and we're out there in some water, and he gets jelly leg syndrome. And I was like, you want jelly legs? Fine. Boom, right down in the water. He realized, oh, this isn't a good place for jelly legs. And I picked him back up. I said, that's why you hold daddy's hand. Don't you wish every moment of life had an immediate consequence like that? That's why you need the Kid Collar 3000. See, you'd want it. That's why you're laughing. You thought I was cruel, but you know how nice that'd be. Ladies, wouldn't you like the Husband Collar 3000? You need to turn around. No, honey, I know where we're going. You know, wouldn't you just love that in the car? If you could just, you know, use the Husband Collar 3000, just get him turned back around. Some of you are like, yeah. You couldn't do it to kids, but you could do that to a consenting adult, right? Don't you wish God had a dog collar like that for you? As soon as you had that thought, just snap you out of it. But there ain't one for your kids. There ain't one for your husband. And God doesn't have one for you. I'll give you the phone. If you can find the app for him, I'll just let you have it right there, man. There's no dog collar out there when you keep saying, gimme, gimme, gimme. He ain't going to push a button and snap you back. Eventually, he's just going to give it to you. And so he gets what he wants, and so this is not long after that. He took everything he had, and he set off for a distant country. And he squandered his wealth in wild living. And that word wild living literally means out of control. It means out of control. There's no restraint. There's no guideline for it. It's I will do whatever I want to do. And the thing about wild living is, and here's the deal, talking about that dog collar thing, is there is a consequence eventually for a bad decision. The problem, though, in life is that, you know, if you had the dog collar 3000 on somebody, it'd be an immediate consequence. Oh, I love the fact that when I let go of Jackson's hand, he drops down in the water, and instantly he realizes dad knows what he's talking about, I will listen. But most life isn't like that. For most of life, there is a long delay between bad decision and consequence. And here's where it gets really destructive. You know what you call that place in between bad decision and consequence? Pleasure. Good times. Party. Let's get wild tonight. It is a good time between a bad decision and the consequence. You made a bad decision at the party at 8 o'clock, and you had a great time until you woke up the next morning and felt consequence, right? What'd you call it? You called it a party. And what are we going to do next Friday night? We're going to do it again, right? Katy Perry, yeah, we're going to do it again. That was a crazy night. We're going to go back and do it again, aren't we? Why? Because there was a consequence, and I forgot about the consequence, and there was going right back to the party. And you see, when you have no control over your finances, what they call that, a spending plan or a budget, when you have no control over what you look at, you haven't made a covenant with your eyes, you just allow your eyes to look at whatever you want to look at, you don't have a covenant with what you drink, you don't have any control over what you drink, how much you drink, when you drink, who you drink around, who you drink with, what you eat, when you eat, how you eat, you don't have any control over any of these areas of your life, and when you allow yourself to go into wild living, which just simply means I don't have any control over it, eventually you hit the consequence. But the problem is, before you hit that consequence, it's all good. And everybody around you is looking at you going, you know, the road you're on is not leading anywhere good. Remember I told you the thing about being lost is you don't realize you're lost until you're really lost? You're thinking, I'm making good time. Honey, don't tell me I don't know where I'm going. If we went that way, there'd be traffic, there'd be stoplights, there's nobody on this road, there are no cops on this road, the speed limit is 70 miles an hour, I don't want to hear that I'm lost, we're making good time. So you just sit back and listen to the radio, right? You don't realize you're lost. You think you're making good time. And the problem with it is that it's all good, it's all good, it's all good, and then eventually the road dead ends. And by that point, you're so far out of the way, you're going to miss the event, and you're going to miss it, and you've missed out. And so it says he ended up going out squandering it all on wild living. It says after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country. They began to be in need. So he went to hire him out to sell to people in that country, and they had him feeding pigs, and he wished he could eat what the pigs were eating. But no one gave him anything. And it says after he had spent everything. And it's a classic old sermon. I've even shared it one time here at this church on Judges 16. Look at the life of Samson. And simple 3 points. I don't know how old this sermon is. It's been taught probably a million times, I think. I don't know, I've heard it over and over and over again. You almost can't get away from it because it's such a true story. Basically says there's three truths about sin. It'll always take you where you never thought you'd go. It'll keep you there longer than you wanted to stay. It'll cost you more than you ever wanted to pay. That's it. It's a road that takes you somewhere you had no idea you'd ever end up at. It keeps you there a whole lot longer than you ever thought you'd stay. You thought you could just entertain that thought, entertain that idea that, you know, this would just be a one weekend thing. This would just be a momentary excursion. It would just be a trip to Vegas. It'd be whatever. It's just going to be this one time. It's not going to matter. And it keeps you there longer than you want to stay. And it costs you a whole lot longer than you ever, a whole lot more than you ever wanted to pay. So it says he went out of that place and it cost him everything. Everything. His money, his friends, his family, his self-respect, it cost him everything. And it says, and then there was a famine in the land. And, you know, when you have that plan, when you're sitting at home and life's all good, and you're thinking about the distant country, you get everything worked out, right? I know how I'm going to get away with this. I know why everybody else gets caught. Everybody else gets caught because they do this dumb move. I watch the video. I watch the video of stupid criminals. I watch that show. It's hilarious. I watch cops. I see how they get caught. I see the dumb things they do. I watch cheaters. I see how they get caught. I see all the dumb things people make. I watch Maury. I watch, you know, all those good shows, good, wholesome, clean shows. I've watched enough Springer to know the things you don't do. If somebody says, go on Springer with me, I know not to go. I got this all figured out. Here's the thing. There is stuff that is beyond your control that you have no control over. He did not see the famine coming, and he had no control over it. And when he worked out his scenarios of how this whole lifestyle would work out, it didn't include the whole land hitting a famine. He had some things that were working. He had some investments he were made that were a little risky, but it didn't matter because everything was going to work out good, and then the housing bubble burst. You didn't see it coming. You didn't see what was going to happen. You can't see those things happening. And it's that old thing that says, you choose to sin, you choose to suffer. And there's this deception that says, it's not going to happen to me. And so eventually it says he came to his senses. And he came to his senses because he ended up somewhere he never thought he'd ever be. That road took him down a place he never thought he'd end up. And, you know, if you ask him back when he was in the Father's house, hey, would you go out and feed pigs? First he'd say, we don't own pigs. They're disgusting. They're unclean animals. We don't have anything to do with them. We're a good Jewish family back in that day. And says, we don't have pigs. And furthermore, it'd be far beneath me to be out there actually feeding and doing manual labor. Don't you realize I'm a son? I'm an overseer. I'm a manager. I don't get involved in that stuff. And there he is doing something he never thought he would ever do in a place he never thought he'd ever be, thinking thoughts he never thought he would ever have. And so it says that helped him come to his senses. And by the way, a little side note, there's a part of this that I want to get to today, but I'm going to wait for next week. I'm an advertising marketing background, so I'm going to give you the commercial for next week. The commercial for next week's topic is, what do you do if you're the parent and you've got a kid who's a prodigal, who's thinking these thoughts? What do you do? You know, how do you handle that situation? We're going to be looking at the answer to that question as best as we can find it from this text next week. So that may make some of y'all want to come back or maybe invite somebody. I don't know. Just wanted you to know that's kind of where we're going next week. So it says he came to his senses. And that's that place where the fog finally lifts. You finally see what you've done. You finally figure out where it is that you're at. And you finally make that U-turn of shame. And, you know, I call it the U-turn of shame, but really it's the first good decision you've made the whole time, isn't it? I've got 1,001 lost stories. I could cherry pick any of them, but I do remember early on when I moved to Virginia Beach, we had a softball game up at It's up off Shore Drive. Is it Bayview, Bay Hill Park? And so I'm on the boulevard. I'm running late, and I'm coming from like Witch Dock down the boulevard, and I'm trying to get my way to Great Neck to make it up. And I see Little Neck, and I think to myself, Little Neck, Great Neck, they're both going the same direction. They both run parallel. I don't know this town well, but hey, who cares? You know, I mean, they're both running parallel. They're both end up the same place. I mean, every road that goes north out of here, every road I've ever taken, go Independence, it ends up over at Shore. Everything seems like you go north, it ends up at Shore Drive eventually, right? Even if it's not called Shore Drive when you get there, it's that still same road, even though, you know, Hampton Roads, everything changes names 16 times. So eventually it's going to be on that same road. It's all good. I'll just take Little Neck straight up. If you know the area, you know where this is going. And it's not going anywhere good. As soon as I said Little Neck, you're like, ooh, yeah, see, because you know where this road goes. I didn't know where the road went. I didn't have the iPhone. I didn't have the iPhone with the old maps, not the new maps. The old maps actually tell you where you're going. I didn't have any of that stuff. I had a big old paper map in the glove box. I'm not going to use that thing. I know where I'm going. So I take the road. And it kind of goes from a commercial thing to kind of a residential thing. I'm like, no big deal. It's looking a little residential. That's okay. The road gets a little bit more narrow. The speed limit drops a little bit more. It gets a little more narrow. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't think this road's going to work. But I didn't have anybody else in the car. I didn't have a nagging wife to say, honey, I think you need to turn around. No, I'm by myself. This is my car. I'll go where I want to go. I took every cul-de-sac at the end of Little Neck Road, and I'll tell you, there ain't no bridge. There's no isthmus. There's no land. There's no footbridge. There ain't nothing. It's just a pretty view of the bay. You know, I took every single one of those to got to the point where I completely missed the game. Because if you're on the wrong road, as we saw at the very beginning, it's never going to lead to the right place. And it wasn't until I finally came to my senses and realized this is not going to work. I got to turn around. And what happens in that moment, we looked last week at the son's confession of what all he says. But there's one piece I kind of skipped over a little bit. And after he says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and earth, and I no longer will be called your son, he says, make me. And he goes on from there. I just want to just stop and pause for a moment on that phrase, make me. You know, when he's living and he's got everything good, and in the back of his mind he's thinking to himself, what I got is good, but it could be better. The words that come out of his mouth are, give me. Once he's realized the mistakes he's made, now what he's saying to his father is, make me. And there's a big shift between give me and make me. There's a different person in the driver's seat of give me and make me. There's a different mentality between give me and make me. And you're looking at God saying, why don't you just give me a better job? Why don't you just give me a better wife? Why don't you just give me better kids? And there's a big shift when you turn your prayer life over and you say, God, why don't you make me a better husband? Why don't you make me a better dad? Why don't you make me better at what I do? Why don't you make me love my job and love the things you've given me? Make me more grateful for everything I have. And there is a big philosophical shift between give me and make me. Because give me is all about, I don't have enough good stuff, God. You've got to give me something more in order for me to be happy. And make me is all about, God, you've already given me everything I need. So just make me someone who can enjoy it. Make me someone who can share in this. Make me somebody who can embrace this. Make me into the person you want me to be, God. So that I can enjoy everything that I have in my life that's just so good. That I don't even realize right now. So, I know everyone in this room, at some point in your life, you've been this kid. Some point, you know, every one of us, you can go to the youngest in the room, to the oldest in the room, and the only difference between the youngest and the oldest is the number of times you've gone down this prodigal son road, right? Because most of us, we don't go down it just one time. We go down it in our finances, and then we go down in our relationships, and then we go down it again in our finances, and we go down it again in our relationships, and we go down it again in our spiritual walk. We continue to go down these roads chasing after one thing after another until we realize that all these roads are all dead ends. And we come back, we have it good for a little while, and eventually we say, God, I need you to give me something else. And so this morning, I just kind of want to ask, you know, right now for some of you in this room, are you on that road right now? And that's a hard question to ask because you don't always know you're on a wrong road until it ends up at a pigsty. But if you're honest with yourself, would you say you're on a wrong road? Are you on a prodigal path? You could just be at the thought stage. You could be in the car driving somewhere that's a bad place. you could have taken that thought and you could have already started the flirtatious action. You could have already started delving into that. You could have already started making little steps in that direction. Are you on that path, and do you need to make that U-turn? Others in this room, you need to realize that you may be where you need to be right now, but you're only one or two dumb decisions. You're only one or two bad thoughts. You're only one or two unchecked ideas away from being right back on that road ever again. And it's easy to convince ourselves, because I'm in church and I finally got back, and I hear this statement all the time. I remember back when I did the prodigal thing. Oh, so you're good now. You'll never make another mistake again. You'll never hit. Nope. Once again, we don't think our thoughts are evil. We don't think our thoughts are heading in that direction. We don't even realize we're on a road that may be going down that way again. And you may not take the same bad road, but there's plenty other ways. There's plenty of the roads you can take that don't end up at the right park. And then lastly, have your prayer life been all about God, give me? And does it need to change to God, make me? Have you been convinced that there's something in your life that you got to have in order for you to be happy? Or are you to the point, without having to learn the hard way, God, just make me grateful for what I have. Make me embrace my place, my situation, my setting. Make me a better husband, a better father. I think there's enough there for you to think about, to chew on, and reflect on as we go to God in prayer.